The informational hearing and public safety overview. This is a joint meeting of the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee. The purpose of these hearings, started on yesterday, is to provide all of us with an overview of the public safety system and how the various components and agencies are linked with each other. With us this afternoon is Ms. Marla Ray, again, to walk us through our agenda for this afternoon, but I would like to start by saying a huge thank you to Ms. Ray and all of the public safety partners and participants in yesterday's overview. Very well done. We appreciate all of the thought and hard work and creativity injected into those presentations. Thank you. And we know that we can expect more of the same this afternoon. Welcome.
Chair Gordley, members of the various committees, good afternoon. For your record, my name is Marla Ray. I'm acting as the volunteer facilitator for these presentations. The praise, Chair Gordley, really goes to those career professionals that have been involved in putting together the program and describing for you the challenges that they face on a day-to-day basis. So on behalf of the entire cast, thank you very much. Yesterday, you received from us a presentation on the adult and juvenile criminal justice agencies. You met Chris. Today, as I mentioned yesterday, you'll meet Chris's family as we focus today's presentation on the dependency justice system. We're talking here about child abuse and neglect. You'll hear about the entire process from the incident to the investigation, the assessment and the case management, representation and advocacy services, and the court process, and then prevention and intervention. As we recommended yesterday, it would probably be best, unless it's an urgent, pressing concern, to make notes and try to reserve your questions, if at all possible, for tomorrow when we do the wrap-up. That would help facilitate things greatly, I think, but there will be those instances where it just can't wait. In addition, the chair and Senator Prozanski yesterday asked for some follow-up information concerning mental health, concerning services available to girls and women in the system, as well as overrepresentation of minorities, and we are prepared to address those issues with you tomorrow. So that's what we're planning on doing today. At this point, I would like to turn things over to Nancy Miller, Deputy State Court Administrator in the Oregon Judicial Department, our third and equal branch of government, and also Ramona Foley. Ramona is a absolutely charming administrator of the Children, Adult, and Families section of the Department of Human Services. That, by the way, doesn't mean that Nancy's not charming. It's just I'm smitten with Ramona's accent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Westland.
I now believe I can say that anyone wearing red at the dais in the witness stand is definitely charming, and those not wearing red are equally as charming.
Be careful, Senator Westland.
I think you're charming, too.
Please continue.
We just got training.
Madam Chair, chairs of the other committees and members, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. As Marla said, I am the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations with the Oregon Judicial Department, and with me is...
For the record, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an Assistant Director at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families.
I want to talk to you just a little bit about what's in your packet. In your packet behind tab 9 in your binder, you will find the script for the skit that we'll be doing today. The script has changed numerous times, so if you see departures from the script, don't be surprised. The one that I brought with me today is titled Final Really of the Skit, so it's a little bit different. Behind that are an actual set of case materials that you would find in a juvenile court case. We took this fictional family and prepared all of the case materials, the court orders, all the different reports you would see, so that if you have an interest in really walking through what a juvenile court case looks like, those materials would help you. We are trying to convey to you a very complex system in a very short period of time today. So as you were told yesterday, the skit really makes short work of some things that would be very complex. Yesterday you met Chris. Today you'll meet Chris's children, Jason and Justin, and their mother, Sally Lewis. Yesterday, the skit ended with the possibility that maybe Chris would be successful and be released, or maybe he would end up in prison. Our story starts today with Chris being in prison. He was actually sentenced to 24 months. They messed that up yesterday. We have it right today. And he's done 1 year of that sentence. I'd like to introduce our players to you, the people joining us, Nancy Keeling with the Department of Human Services, Officer Nelson from the Kaiser Police Department, the Honorable Deanne Darling, Clackamas County Circuit Judge, Michelle DeBrissay, yes, you may walk, Michelle DeBrissay, who is an Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County, Timothy Travis with the State Court Administrator's Office, Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Jean Ann Quinn with the State Court Administrator's Office, Becky Smith, the Statewide CASA Coordinator, Benjamin Hazelton, the Citizen Review Board Field Supervisor, and playing the grandmother, Leola McKenzie, also from the State Court Administrator's Office. You can see that I heavily recruited from my staff for this skit. Chris's former partner, Sally Lewis, is raising their two children, Justin, age 2, and Jason, age 5. She's also raising Jennifer, age 15, her teenage daughter from a previous relationship. Jennifer's currently in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority on a drug charge. She's in a treatment program. Our story starts today with a phone call being made to the DHS hotline alleging that Ms. Lewis is using methamphetamine and that her son, Jason, is wandering around the neighborhood unattended and begging for food. Given the meth allegations, DHS contacts law enforcement and a caseworker and a police officer respond to the home.
As you can see from the assessment referral in your packets, this is a complex family system. All children in the household must receive an assessment. The information gathered during the 30 to 60-day assessment process will lead to an assessment conclusion by DHS and will point to a direction for the service plan. Often, caseworkers must complete their child safety assessment while working parallel with a possible criminal investigation conducted by law enforcement. It is not uncommon for there to be a substantiated child abuse assessment and for law enforcement to drop criminal charges. One action does not stop the other from moving forward, since there are different legal standards for these two actions, and those standards apply to child protective services and for criminal prosecutions.
So today, when the officer and caseworker arrive at the home, the officer makes several observations, including the fact that the home is in extremely poor condition. There's garbage everywhere, there's no food in the kitchen, there's a foul odor in the house with dirty clothing and clutter everywhere. They also see beer cans and drug paraphernalia in the house. The officer sees a plastic baggie of white crystalline powder on the coffee table. The caseworker and the officer find that the conditions reasonably jeopardize the children's welfare. So, we will join the officer and the worker.
Stop, stop, stop. Ms. Lewis, we're going to be taking you to custody today for possession of a controlled substance.
Ms. Lewis, is there a relative who can care for your children, or is their father a resource?
No.
There will be a juvenile court hearing for the children tomorrow morning. We'll arrange to have you transported from jail so you can participate in the planning for your children.
Thanks for coming. At this time, I'll be taking you to jail.
Hello, Mr. Smith.
Hello.
Thank you so much for your willingness to care for Justin and Jason. Let's sit down and talk about all the background information on the children and their current needs. I will also leave you a packet of information. Please call me if there are any issues of concern. The shelter hearing is scheduled for tomorrow at 11 a.m.
Thank you very much.
On the next court day, the case will come before the juvenile court for a shelter hearing. The purpose of the hearing is to determine whether there was probable cause to remove the children and whether the agency made reasonable efforts to prevent the removal and whether it's in the children's best interest to remain in foster care. Simultaneously, the mother will have a criminal case moving forward on the drug charge. We'll move now to the shelter hearing.
We're here today for the shelter hearing in the matter of Justin and Jason Lewis. It's already been determined that this family qualifies for court-appointed counsel. Therefore, an attorney will be appointed for the children, one for the mother, one for the father. I've had I'll be requesting the appointment of a CASA. I've read the police reports, the protective custody reports, and reviewed the photos. It's my understanding that there was methamphetamine found in the home. The home was very dirty. There was no edible food, and one of the neighbors returned the 5-year-old after he was found wandering in the apartment complex in search of food. It's further my understanding that the mother is currently in jail. Ms. Keeling, have you been able to locate the father?
There is a legal father, Your Honor. He is in prison serving the second year of a 2-year sentence.
Have you been able to place these children in a home together?
Yes, Your Honor.
About relatives?
They are currently not placed with relatives, but we anticipate that that will happen soon.
Mother, anything you wish to say?
I'd like to have my children returned when I get out of jail. Their grandmother is here. I would like them to stay with her.
Ms. Debrazay.
Your Honor, the criminal history records indicate that Ms. Lewis has a criminal history for possession of controlled substance, driving under the influence, and some failures to appear. It's my belief she'll be subject to the system based upon those things, as well as her current charge. I do expect that she will stay in custody for a while longer. Your Honor, we'd ask the court to find that there's probable cause in this case, as the conditions of the home did endanger the welfare of the children. We'd further ask that you continue them in foster care as return to either parent isn't possible.
I find that there was no alternative to removal, and therefore the agency's made reasonable efforts. Further find that the parents are currently unavailable as parenting resources for their children. The case will be set out 60 days for the purpose of determining if there will be jurisdiction and any dispositional plans, and I direct the agency to begin visits supervised at DHS with the mother upon her release from custody. Further direct the Child Welfare Agency to prepare the necessary service agreement outlining what the mother is expected to do to be a parenting resource for her children. Further requesting that counsel and CASA be in touch with all members of this family immediately.
Your Honor, excuse me, Your Honor, could you please tell those of us who don't know what a CASA is, what does the acronym stand for?
Court-appointed special advocates, volunteers in the community trained and appointed by judges to advocate for children in the child welfare system, particularly the foster care system.
Thank you.
The next event is a team decision meeting in order to develop the case plan and determine the most appropriate placement for the children. A team decision meeting is a facilitated meeting with the parents, extended family, community partners, service providers, and child welfare staff for the purpose of making child safety and child placement decisions. And now for the team decision meeting.
We have all discussed the services needed, and my client, the mother, agrees to participate in drug and alcohol evaluation and in parenting classes. We recommend that the children be placed with their paternal grandmother, Mrs. Bridges. Is you?
I haven't met my clients yet. The children are staying with the foster home, but I have spoken with the grandmother, and she believes that both the children will need medical evaluations due to the possibility that they were exposed to methamphetamine in the home.
DHS will set up weekly visits at the office between the mother and the children. We'll do a criminal background check and a home study on Mrs. Bridger and move the children to her home if she is an appropriate placement resource. We already have medical appointments scheduled for both children. We will refer Mrs. Lewis to a self-sufficiency worker.
Let's talk for a moment about the services. The agency will spend the days before the jurisdictional or dispositional hearing working with the mother and the children and arranging their participation in services. The agency, during the period of time, will also be working with the attorneys and the CASA to develop the service plan for the case. The mother can voluntarily participate in services before the next court hearing in order to speed the return of the children. A parent can also refuse to participate in services until the court finds jurisdiction in the case. DHS will make contact with the father in the penitentiary to gather information about his circumstances. DHS will also complete a foster home certification process for the grandmother.
I was released from jail and I'm living with friends. I was evicted after the arrest and my health insurance ends at the end of the month. I have no income. I have no car. I visit my children at the DHS office each week. I've participated in drug and alcohol evaluation, treatments recommended, but there aren't any openings at the local treatment program. I don't want to leave town because I wouldn't be able to visit my children. My lawyer talks to me on a regular basis to prepare for the hearing next month.
The children have had medical exams. Jason continues in Head Start. His grandmother is providing transportation. The grandmother needs respite daycare. We are working closely with DHS and the children's lawyer to make sure the children's needs are met.
We're now 60 days into the case and moving to the jurisdiction and disposition hearing.
We're here today to see if we can resolve any of the allegations in the petition without the need to proceed to a trial. Ms. Debrazay, state's position?
Your Honor, we've had a pretrial conference prior to this hearing, and I've had an opportunity to discuss the case with the mother's lawyer and with Ms. Lewis, and it's my understanding that she doesn't want to have a trial today, that in fact she wants to admit that an amended allegation is true, and it's my understanding that she plans to admit that her alcohol and substance abuse problem, if it's left untreated, would impair her ability to provide adequate care to her children, and that creates a substantial risk of harm. Your Honor, I have also discussed this matter with the father's attorney, and it's my understanding he also plans to admit that he's currently incarcerated and that he's not available as a custodial resource for the child.
May it please the court. Your Honor, my client is prepared to stipulate to the amended allegation as recited by the district attorney.
Ms. Lewis, is it true that you agree that the state would be able to prove the allegations about you in the petition regarding your drug problem and how it affects your children?
Yes, ma'am.
Since we were not able to arrange for the transport of the father today, we'll set that portion of the case over, but we'd like to proceed with the mother's piece. Ms. Keeling.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you tell me what the plan and the concurrent plan is in the case and what's currently going on with these children?
Yes, Your Honor. The mother has completed a drug and alcohol evaluation. Treatment was recommended. DHS moved the children to their paternal grandparents' home. She is now a certified relative placement. The mother has been referred for services and visitation continues. We have sent a letter to the father in prison. The parents have no Native American heritage, so we have ruled out the Indian Child Welfare Act. The plan is to return the children to their mother if she successfully completes the service plan and evidences an ability to safely parent her children. The concurrent plan, Your Honor, is adoption by the grandmother.
Has the children's attorney had time to meet with the clients and gather information?
Yes, Your Honor. I met with Justin and Jason at their grandmother's home. It seems that Justin's been having some behavioral difficulties in the home, and I would request that DHS arrange for an assessment to determine whether he would be eligible for early intervention services.
CASA input?
Yes, Your Honor. I have met with the children at the Head Start and also in the grandmother's home. I support the assessment to determine if they need early intervention services. The children appear to be nicely settled in at the grandmother's home and flourishing there. I recommend that the children remain in the home. DHS continue to offer services to the mother until the child can be returned home, as well as actively work on the concurrent plan.
Is the grandmother or the former foster parent present?
Yes, Your Honor. We've been working with the agency and the grandmother very closely. The transition of the children went very well, and we do agree with the plan that the agency has outlined.
Thank you. I find that the children are within the jurisdiction of the court. The custody of the DHS will continue. I approve the plan of return to mother, the concurrent plan of adoption by relatives. Further order the approval of the service agreement that the agency has drawn up and order the mother to comply with it. I would ask the agency to look into whether or not the grandmother can be the supervisor for the visits to free that resource up for another family. I order further that the agency begin to discuss with the grandmother what the adoption process would entail and what it would mean so that you can move forward on that plan should it be necessary. I will set this case out for a hearing 1 year from today for the annual permanency hearing and expect that the Citizens Review Board will review this case 4 months from today, 6 months after that. Case is continued.
It's also important to note here that many parents do choose to have a trial in which the state calls witnesses and proves the allegations in the petition are true by preponderance of the evidence. If there is a contested trial to the court, evidence rules apply, parties can call witnesses and can cross-examine those witnesses. During the 4 months between the court hearing and the citizen review, the agency will continue working with the parents, with the lawyers, with the CASAs, providing services to the children and working with the grandmother. 6 months into the case will be reviewed by the Citizen Review Board, and that's where we are now.
Good afternoon. We are here today to review the case of Justin and Jason Lewis. They've been in foster care now for 6 months, and they're now with their grandmother. We want to give each participant in the review an opportunity to speak with the board, and we will be focusing on the plan for the children and the services in which you are all engaged. Each party attending the review will provide an update to the board as to the status of the case and inform the board if they have any suggested recommendations in this case. The board will then make findings and recommendations to the court and other parties.
The Citizen Review Board reviews all cases of children in foster care. The reviews occur every 6 months unless the court has a hearing instead. And the purpose of the CRB is to ensure that the case plan is appropriate and that it is consistently monitored by an objective group of lay citizens. In this case, and you'll see the recommendations in your packet, the board found the plan to be appropriate but made numerous recommendations for services, including exploration of treatment services in which the children could be placed with their mother. The board also recommended the agency work to develop a service agreement with the father to address long-range planning in case he should be released from prison and could be a resource. Another CRB will be held 6 months after the first, and again, that review is an opportunity to make final recommendations on the permanency plan prior to the permanency hearing. We're now 14 months into the case. Again, between that review and the permanency hearing, the agency will continue to work with the mother, make contact with the father in prison, see if he will be a resource when he gets out, work with the children, and again, with the grandmother. The permanency hearing happens at 14 months.
Now is the time set for the permanency hearing in the matter of Justin and Jason Lewis. I spent the evening last night reviewing the DHS report, the CASA report, and reviewed the two CRB reports in the file. Ms. Keeling, I understand these children have been with their grandmother for a year and out of their parents' care for 14 months. Any additional comments on the status of the plan at this time?
Yes, Your Honor. You're correct. They have been out of home that long. We plan to continue offering services to the mother until she can have the children returned to her care. She did have 3 months of clean urinalysis with one relapse. She now realizes she needs to be in treatment and will be entering a program next week. Our goal is for the children to be able to join her in the program within the next 60 days.
May it please the court, my client very much agrees with that plan.
Father's counsel present today?
Yes, Your Honor. My client has been released from prison. However, I do not know where he is today. When he last called me, he did say he wanted the children to be placed with his mother.
It's the position of the children's attorney.
But, Your Honor, I do not agree with the plan to return the children to their mother. She's relapsed, and we're now 14 months into the case. The program she's entering is a 12-month program. There's no guarantee that she will be successful or that the children will ever be able to be placed there. I've spoken with my clients, and they want permanency. They're happy living with their grandmother, but they would like to remain involved in their mother's life. I believe that guardianship is the most appropriate plan for these children.
Does the grandmother have any comments today?
Of course, Your Honor. I am more than willing to take care of the children and to be a resource for them. But I really believe that the mother deserves a chance. Now she's ready for treatment, and the children really love her and miss her.
CASA's recommendations?
Your Honor, I cannot fully agree with the children's attorney. The children have waited long enough for a permanent home. I believe the plan needs to be changed to adoption by the grandmother. The children are doing very well in that home and need the continued stability that the grandmother offers. The mother has had at least one dirty UA in the past 3 months and is facing a probation violation, which I am concerned has spurred her recent interest in treatment. She has not demonstrated the consistent awareness of the children's basic needs that I think are in their best interest.
Members of the committee, this is not an unusual situation. I face this probably daily in my courtroom. I am not a judge who does juvenile 5 days a week because my county is not that to that level yet, although it's growing. I've been doing it for 10 years. 2 days a week, I do these cases all day long, and I do 2 to 3 of them every hour. You're welcome to come to my courtroom or the courtroom of anybody who fits in my position throughout the state and see what really goes on. These pressures are abbreviated but not unique. Families wish to be together. Families wish to care for each other. Drug addiction takes a long time to grab hold and a long time to get rid of. The law says we must move forward quickly for the developmental needs of children and quickly place them in their permanent homes. Yet they know full well who their parents are. Often, as inadequate as they may be at the moment, they love them deeply. And the constant tug and pull between the government's rights and families and the family's rights to run itself and what we should expect of our parents and what we should provide to our children is a challenge I face daily. Parents, oftentimes we have grandparents are our primary care providers for children, relatives, and then, of course, the foster care system when the parents can't care for the children. The children that come into my courtroom are not children in need and love and a little guidance. These are damaged and troubled children who need much help, much service, much attention. I have 2 children before me today who are 2 and 5. Today I have to decide, will their mother be forgotten as their mother, and will their grandmother become their mother? Will their mother be set aside and their grandmother raise them, or will we wait more than 14 months for this drug addiction to go away and this mother to get her children? What would you do? I am no better than the information that gets provided to me every day, and I'm dependent upon everybody standing here to give me the information I need so that I can hope the decisions I make are the best possible for children and their parents. Thank you.
I want to thank all of our SCIP members and especially thank Marla Ray, who was willing to play our mother today. She is not a meth addict.
Ms. Miller, before the members of the SCIP get away, if you all could again hold up the placards so that we can see the link between the position the position that you're playing and the funding source. That's one of the things you're trying to communicate to us today. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you all players and thank you for your patience. Madam Chair, other chairs and committee members will now move into the description of these 4 components of the system. Marla, are you hovering?
Yes, I'm hovering.
We'll try to get through these within the time that we've allotted to each of these. The first component this afternoon, investigation, assessment, and case management. You will hear from Una Swanson and Kevin George, both with DHS in Children, Adult, and Families.
Good afternoon. And I would ask the panelists, if you make reference to documents in our notebook, would you tell us what page you're on so that we can follow along?
Certainly.
Thank you.
I'm the only one with a notebook, Madam Chair.
Okay.
C
Senator Gourley, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George. I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services for Children, Adults, and Families. And we are going to begin this section on tab number eight, page 8-3 is where we're going to begin here. And it actually looks like the slides that are overhead as well.
Thank you.
Senator Gourley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And I will begin on page 8-4, and we'll be following the PowerPoint. In the investigation, assessment, and case management of child abuse investigations, there are two entities that are identified: law enforcement, which includes state police, local sheriffs, and police departments, and the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families, specifically Child Welfare Services. And Child Welfare Services are represented in local offices throughout the state. And as the two entities identified to receive reports of abuse and respond to those, we respond to reports of child abuse and neglect, meaning that as a reporter from the public, you can choose to contact local law enforcement, you can choose to contact child welfare offices and make reports of child abuse. From that point forward, law enforcement and child protective services, part of child welfare services, we have a responsibility to cross-report to one another, law enforcement to us, and us to law enforcement. We provide child protective service investigations and assessments, and in that process, if we're working with law enforcement is, of course, addressing the criminal aspect, and child protective services are looking specifically at the family issues and the immediate safety needs of children. We provide protective custody for children who cannot be safe in their own homes. And as was represented in the skit, we make all reasonable efforts to prevent removal and demonstrate that through to the court if that's necessary. We provide services to parents and determine how the child's safety was compromised when we intervene with a family. And we assess the capacity that a parent may have to make change in a child's time, to make the changes they need to provide a safe environment for their child, and identify those services that can meet those core needs.
I'm picking up on page 8-6. As you saw in the skit you just previewed, we then also provide substitute care. And substitute care ends up being a real broad definition of any time a child is placed out of their home. So substitute care actually includes foster care. You'll hear the term relative care. You'll hear the term residential treatment. Those are all forms of a substitute care or out-of-home care for a child. So it's any time they're placed out of their home. The children that are coming into our systems at this point in time as a result of the drug abuse are really demonstrating kids with complex needs and require an increasing number of services and supports in order to care for these children. We oftentimes will ask for relatives and try to find relative placements whenever possible, and currently we place about 30% of all of our children with our relatives. We identify this as really temporary foster care, and it's a temporary placement. As the judge talked about, the real goal is to look at a permanency option for children. And so foster care is considered to be a temporary resource for children and not a place for children to grow up. As we then look at the permanency options, we then move towards an adoption plan as a permanency option for a child if we cannot return them home. We also look at other options such as guardianship for children with relatives and others.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winters.
Currently, how many children do we have in foster care?
Chair Gourley, Senator Winters, you're hiding behind a...
I'm not hiding it.
Couldn't see you over there. We actually have around 6,800 children in care at this point in time. When you start in family foster care, when we include residential treatment, we're more at 7,500 children at a time.
And what's the percentage of those children that you currently have are in the process of moving towards termination of parental rights?
Senator Gordley, Chair Gordley, Senator Winters, actually I don't have that number off the top of my head. We can certainly get it and provide it to the committee, though.
Just a little information for members who don't know, the by statute, where you have a child or family that's that is drug related, and that the agency is working with, and if there aren't the results in treatment, I believe they have a year by statute to clean up. If not, then the agency can begin to proceed with termination of parental rights.
Thank you. Please continue.
Senator Gordley.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick questions. We'll want the subcommittee, so I'll give you a heads up now to get them to us, because we'll be looking at it again. Length of time from starting any parental rights to adoption, on average, what that number is doing, is it increasing again or is it decreasing again? I've heard it's increasing again. I like to see that figure. Also, a statement was made, I thought, and it was very quickly, I kind of lost it there. Did one of you say that one of your goals is to prevent the children from leaving the home, to try to place them back in the home?
Chair Gordley, Senator Bates, yes, I referenced that, that when at the Child Protective Service assessment, the initial contact with the family, when we intervene with the family and we believe there's no alternative to removal, we are responsible to demonstrate to the court that we have made all reasonable efforts, or in the case of the Indian Child Welfare Act, children that apply to the Act, that we've made all active efforts. There are situations where no efforts could be made given the circumstances, but we have to provide that information to the court at the shelter hearing.
Follow up.
Certainly.
One of the concerns we had in the last 5 years I've been involved, and it's actually 25 or 30 years as a physician, is that I am concerned that the needs of the children are commonly secondary to the needs of the parents and the family, and that has led to a continuation of what we're seeing now, generation after generation after generation, including placement with relatives who are a little better equipped to handle those children than the parents themselves. Those parents are often the result of the home you're placing adopted children back into. That's a basic policy shift that we've talked about, and there's a lot of ramifications on the federal and state level. We'd like to see a full discussion of that in the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Chair Gordley. I'm then on page 8-7. All children who are reported assessed as victims of abuse or neglect are the children we actually are affecting through our services of investigation, assessment, and case management. A number of these children are also being served then through private agencies across the state. And at this time, we have over 250 different private child placing agencies that care for some of these children. Those would be the ones that would be the terminology we used earlier around residential treatment centers that are caring for these children. We also then are affected, as you saw very skillfully in the skit, the number of people in the organizations and agency that are part of this plan for children in terms of the court system, the district attorney's office, the court-appointed special advocates, the citizen review boards, amongst other players in state and local governments. The child welfare organization is actually funded from a number of different funding sources, both state and federal. We have a significant number of state general fund dollars that we use, and those dollars are oftentimes used to match federal grants that are available to us. And the federal grants then are providing a number of dollars to the state. Under the Social Security Act, we have a number of programs that we access federal funding for, and the terms that we have used there are the Title IV-B, Title IV-E, as you can read those. And those are all different, unique grants that provide opportunities for foster care, for adoptions, for child protective services, and for family preservation services for families. We also use our temporary assistance to needy families, which oftentimes in previous sessions has been called the aid to family with dependent children. And that, again, is another federal program. We also use the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act and other funds through child support, through our collaboration with Department of Justice, who look to get child support from families when children are in foster care. We actually will go after the families and ask for child support for those children and other Social Security resources that the children might be available for.
Chair Gordley, other members of the committee, some of the cost drivers within our system are the state and federal statutes and mandates. Examples of those might be the ASFA time frames that were talked about in the skit. Another example might be, as Senator Bates mentioned, we have to make reasonable efforts findings, and those are tied closely to federal and Oregon mandates. The number of child abuse and neglect reports, we continue to take the number of child abuse and neglect reports that there are to take, and certainly that number is rising. Number of children who enter substitute care, their length of stay, and their cost of care, certainly as represented in the skit, the issues within families are complex. We now have more children entering care than leaving care. And adoption assistance for finalized adoptions, this number is cumulative. There are more children on adoption assistance than in foster care.
Excuse me, just a moment. Representative Shields, there are several vacancies up front if you'd like to come up and join the panel. And if there are any other members in the audience that I don't recognize because we have a number of new people, please come forward and join the panel. Please continue.
Okay. I've now moved on to... the complexity of the cases that we see are certainly a cost driver. We are seeing parents who have a multitude of issues. We are not routinely seeing parents who are impacted by just one issue. There may be mental illness and substance abuse and criminality all involved. Substance abuse is certainly a cost driver. I'm sorry.
Hold your thought. Senator Winters.
Some questions that I know will that given you a little advanced time that will come up in subcommittee, and that's the number of children that you know that are in the system that are in foster care that will not, for all, because of the problem that exists with the child, that will not be available for, or is not adoptable, if you could have that ready for us at the, and what are the plans for those children? And then the other one is where you do the independent contracts, particularly for assessment with respect to abuse. What is the turnaround time for them to get their reports back to you if you have that definitively required by each one of these independent agencies? And I'm talking in terms of where you have assessment centers that are actually, in fact, doing the some analysis, and they're to report back to you or to the parent. What is the length of time that we require so that parents and others aren't in limbo waiting for these reports to come back? Is there 30 days, or just what is those time periods?
Okay. Back to the cost drivers, substance abuse, certainly methamphetamine use is a serious problem in our state as well as across the country, and we have certainly seen the impact of that particular drug use on not just child welfare, but on all of us as members of the community and the impact it has on criminal activity as well as the very damaging impact it has on families. The economy, unemployment, poverty certainly have an impact on our system. We would never say that poverty in and of itself is a source of child abuse, but certainly those risk factors and those stressors on family can contribute to that. Technology needs, I think some examples of that are the internal systems that we use to record the information about child welfare cases and the efficiencies that we need to gain in that system of documenting that work both to meet federal and state mandates.
The next area that I turn us to is the areas of discretion on 8.11. Child Welfare has some areas of discretion when we look to answer this question for you. There is some decision on the alleged abuse and neglect. Certainly it's based on Oregon statute and what we are doing as far as an investigation and looking at what constitutes child abuse. We also have placement resource selection, and that's real broad terminology to be able to say that it is the agency's responsibility to make decisions about where these children are placed. Are they placed with a foster home? Are they placed with a relative? Are they placed in residential treatment centers? Judges make the ruling to have the children be removed from their home, and then it's the agency's responsibility to determine the most appropriate placement for those children. We also have the discretion then of selecting contractors. We have a number of contracts, as I talked about earlier, for our residential treatment services, in addition to other types of services that we provide for our families and our children while they're in home. And we do have some discretion over that. Those services often look like, or more example, around counseling classes or counseling individually for parents, drug and alcohol treatment programs we might be contracting with, parenting classes, those type of services. We also have our substitute care, again, the foster care special rates, and special contracts. The special rate program is a program where we are providing additional support dollars and or services to foster parents in order to care for children. Again, these children are coming with very complex needs, and their skills that they actually need assistance on from the foster parents requires foster parents to be providing increased level of parenting that a normal child would not necessarily be receiving. And specialized contracts, oftentimes that is a matter of trying to find somebody or some facility who can take a child with the extraordinary needs that they actually have. We, at this time, would also open up for any questions you might have. We would certainly like to thank the chair for the opportunity to come and talk about our programs in a real high-level overview today. And I understand clearly this is not the level of detail that we'll be getting into later.
Thank you very much for your presentations. I would like to call on Representative Wisnott, so that we can get some additional questions on the record for you to follow up on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Swanson, I know when you talked about you seek child support when the children are placed in foster homes. Is there a statute for that that requires you to do that, and do you do it in all cases? What is your success rate in collecting it, and what happens to those funds?
Yeah. Chair Gordley, Representative Winsett, I actually spoke about the Department of Justice and Child Support, and we do seek child support on all of our cases. I don't have the information exactly to what level we're able to actually claim those funds, but we'll certainly have it for you at a later time in committees. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, that kind of detail you will hear a lot about in the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means when you take up the budget for the Department of Justice. It is a very substantial role for the department, and they have all kinds of fun facts to know and tell about child support collections and where the money goes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll now move into our next segment. This will concern representation and advocacy. We will be at slide 8-12. Your presenters include Kelly Sky from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Becky Smith from the Court Appointed Special Advocates, and Michelle Debrisay, Deputy District Attorney in Montgomery.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley, members of the committee. I'll be following the slides. We'll start out with who we are. Prosecutors within the court system are both county deputy district attorneys and state assistant attorneys general, depending on the jurisdiction and whether they use the county or the state attorneys. Public defense attorneys is a little bit of a misnomer in the juvenile arena, because what we really are court-appointed attorneys appointed to represent both parents and children. In each case, each parent is appointed an attorney, and the children are generally appointed one attorney unless it's determined by the judge that the children have conflicting legal interests. And court-appointed special advocates are specially trained advocates for the children, and the unique thing about CASAs is each advocate is appointed to just one child or one family of children, so they don't carry a caseload. They are just one individual who has one family, so they have a little bit more time to spend with them. What we do, prosecutors and assistant attorneys general represent the interests of the citizens of Oregon by enforcing the child welfare laws and enforcing the child dependency laws. Then, if children are in care for too long, the prosecutors and assistant attorneys generals will get involved again by initiating termination of parental rights proceedings and carrying that through the court process. The court-appointed attorneys represent the parents and the children in these same proceedings, dependency and termination proceedings. Often the court-appointed attorneys will represent the legal rights of their clients in proceedings outside of the courtroom, such as school suspension hearings for the children, or if the parent has a pending criminal case, that attorney may have dual representation in the criminal and the juvenile matter. The court-appointed special advocates then, as I said, they're trained volunteers. They represent the interests of the children. I think it's important to distinguish the difference between the child's attorney and the CASA. The child's attorney has an ethical obligation to represent the child's interest. If that child is old enough to make a decision as to what their interests are, we are ethically bound to represent that child's interest. So if I represent a 12-year-old who desperately wants to go back and live with his mother, despite the fact that I may not personally feel that that's the best plan for that child, I must do everything that I can to advocate for that child to return to home, and that may include working with the mother's attorney to try to help the mother get in a position where she can have the child back. When the child is too young to make that decision, then I may become in a situation where I have to make a best interest determination on my own to determine what I will advocate for. The CASA comes from a different perspective. They come from a community perspective, and they have an independent judgment as to what they think is in the child's best interest. So the CASA is in a position where if that 12-year-old desperately wants to go home, that they may be advocating for something different if they have come to the conclusion that that's not in the child's best interest.
Senator Bates. Excuse me.
Senator Garley. What age do you think it's appropriate for a child to make the decision that, considering especially these children come from terribly dysfunctional homes and they have a lot of emotional problems, including inappropriate bonds to the parents sometimes, dependent relationships, at what age do you think it's appropriate for that child to make the kind of decision you just talked about?
Well, Chair Gordley, Senator Bates, that is a very interesting question. It's one that is in constant debate at our ethics educational courses. Juvenile attorneys banter with that question ourselves. We certainly make that decision on a case-by-case basis, because sometimes we may get an extremely mature 7-year-old versus a 12-year-old who has developmental disabilities, and that is generally a decision for that court-appointed attorney to make, just whether they think that that child can make that decision for themselves. And sometimes when it's in the gray area, we will present all sides. We will say, this is what the child wants. This is what the child wants me to advocate for. These are some concerns I have about that decision, and let the court know why it is that I am questioning whether the child can make that judgment, and make sure that the court has all the information that that I think is important.
Yeah.
But it's a very good question, and one that's troubling.
Do you ever get a psychiatric evaluation of the child before that decision is made?
We frequently, excuse me, Senator Gordley, Senator Bates, we frequently get psychiatric evaluations. Oftentimes we will ask the agency to get an evaluation, and they will do that. And generally that is not done in time to make the initial decision as to the competency of the child. But that will come into play. There generally always will be an evaluation if there's some question along those lines. As the child's attorney, if I have a question about the child's competency, then it would be my duty to make sure that the court has all the information that I have taken into consideration in making my best interest determination.
Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
I'd like to just follow up on the question regarding the age for competence. I thought the court had a bright line test as to a certain age before their decisions or their wishes were going to be handled. What I'm hearing, though, is that, if, as you said, Kelly, that if a 7-year-old seems to have enough wherewithal to make those decisions, you are bound to advocate for those, even though the age, I mean, at age 7, is that correct?
Again, it's a, excuse me, Chair Gordley, Center presents the, again, it's a case-by-case determination, and no, there is no law, there is no bright-line rule, and I just missed over say, and as I said, this is a topic of a lot of conversation amongst attorneys who practice in this area, because it does put us in a precarious position at times. But there is no bright-line rule, and we are just required to make that on a case-by-case basis and hope that we have the training that's necessary, and would consult with the CASA and with other family members if we had questions.
One follow-up, if I may.
Certainly.
Regarding that determination, I understood also that sometimes that you will present to the court the multiple sides with the issues. Could you tell us if you feel that in your practice, not individually, but what you've seen, how many other advocates for the child would actually present only the child's side as compared to giving the court the, let's say, the most information, most informed for he or she to make that decision as to what was the best course for the child?
I think I understand what you're getting at, and I think that I wouldn't say that any advocate would intentionally not present all sides or all the information that they think is important to the court. The difference is perspective. And the best way to give you an example of that is the defense attorney's perspective on something versus the prosecutor's perspective. They're just different. And so if as the child's attorney, if I know that I have an ethical responsibility to represent what this, just to make it simple, what this 12-year-old wants, I am going to, my perspective is going to be that I need to find whatever avenue I can to get this result that this child wants. And if that is getting back together with a family that other people feel is not an appropriate resolution, I'm with that perspective, I'm going to work harder to find the resources to make that happen for that child. Whereas if I am a CASA or a deputy district attorney who just doesn't feel that that getting the family back together is the appropriate resolution for the case, they may not be working as hard to make that result happen. And so that's where representing that child's legal right to have a voice is important, because it's the perspective, and it gives me the ability to hire experts and to investigate the case in a way that someone coming from a different perspective may not do. And that way we know for sure that if we're denying that child what they want, that they've had every possible chance to have what they wanted, and they had legal representation, their rights were protected, and that decision was made.
Thank you.
Senator Winters?
Has there been any studies or anything done that went back in time to determine if our outcomes are better since we, and recognize I've been around these halls a long time, and I was here when we started some of these programs back when I was on the executive side. But I'm wondering if we've done any studies to look at whether all of these new pieces that we've added, particularly talking about, you know, having counsel for the child and the CASA and all of those, and did any comparison when we did not have them, whether or not the results today are better than the results that we had, let's say, in the 80s or 71. What kind of longitudinal studies, if any, have we done to do any comparison as to what we're doing is having a favorable outcome for the child, because the child becomes the number one piece.
Chair Gordley, Senator Winters, I personally don't know what those studies would be, but I think that we can find out what that information is, either from the District Attorneys Association or from the Indigent Defense Sources, so I suspect we can find that.
Mr. Taylor, did you wish to speak to this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this issue has come up before, and I think what we should be touching along is also the right to counsel to kids and parents. When you come to a criminal case, it is very clear when you charge someone with a crime, there's a possibility of jail time, no matter how remote they have the right to counsel. When it comes to parents, and most people feel that it also applies to kids, the right is a case-by-case analysis. We have two cases, one to the United States Supreme Court, one from the Oregon Court of Appeals. They're both factually similar in the sense that one parent was in prison for life for murder, and they wanted to be present, to be represented, have counsel at the dependency hearing or the termination of parental rights, and the courts under those circumstances said it's a case-by-case analysis. What is very difficult here is that it's probably true as you get closer to termination of parental rights, they all have a liberty interest. The parents have a liberty interest in their kids. The kids have a liberty interest in their parent. And in all probability, they have a right to counsel. Problem is, you get closer to that, it's less clear at the start. But the problem is, you get a catch-22. As you get closer to the termination of parental rights, it probably prejudices their rights, in many cases, not to have counsel at the beginning. Having said that, it seems to vary from county to county on when counsel is appointed. There are some preliminary studies, and we've tried to find additional ones, particularly since the federal law that comes in, that indicates that when the kids and the parents have counsel, the matter comes to a conclusion a lot faster than if they did not have counsel, which means that the kid is likely to spend less time in foster care if counsel is involved than if counsel is not involved. That's preliminary studies.
Chair Gordley, if I may, we've made a note of the interest of that. You'll also, as we get quickly through the balance of this presentation on representation and advocacy, some of the areas that concern cost drivers as well as those limited areas in this regard, areas of discretion. So if we can keep moving through this quickly, we still have the courts and prevention and intervention to get through this afternoon.
I think we're doing just fine on time and appreciate that committee members are asking very pertinent questions.
And I need to follow, because I know if I don't ask it, I think that if it's the chair will. And could you break those down along the lines of people of color and those, because we often get generic information, but we do not get that information back of how it impacts other members of our community. And so if there is such data, I would we'd like that to include too, Bill. I particularly, if you're talking about, I know that there used to be data that had to do with the Native American population as we move towards termination of parental rights. What exists if we're talking about the African American population, some of those, and whether they also have the legal community available to them?
Thank you, Senator Winters. One additional question, and then we will move on. Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, just two very quick statements. I don't have my spreadsheet in front of me, but the indigent defense cost that you identified in terms of these types of cases is actually a relatively significant item in indigent defense costs. I mean, it obviously does not compare to criminal, but if I remember correctly, it was about $30 plus million in the last biennium. And I did want to say, just to add a little bit of levity to this, is Martha Ray trying with all these panels to convince us that one of the problems is that there are just too many players in this
you
system?
Marla.
Or Marla Ray. Marla Ray. Yeah, I didn't say that. Marla Ray. Marla Ray. That's a rhetorical question, but
it's not humorous. It's a problem.
It's part of the problem.
I also see that Peter Ozan is in the back of the room taking note of the question that you have raised, Senator Devlin.
Yes.
And that's an issue that we will pick up in the Public Safety Subcommittee. Please continue.
And the one follow-up comment that I would have to that is that these juvenile cases are extremely costly compared to criminal cases in general. So it will appear in the district attorney's budget, in the Public Defense Services Commission budget. They're costly items because they're long cases. They last for sometimes years and years. And they should take up a lot of our resources, because when you're talking about terminating a parent's rights, you're talking about permanently breaking up a family, and it's something that we shouldn't do without being willing to spend some resources to do it. On who we affect, I think that this sort of has been touched on. It goes without saying. We have all of these players really affect all Oregon, all Oregonians, because the more healthy families that we have, the more healthy of a society that we have. And research has shown that early intervention in children's lives will reduce their future criminal activity and their future substance abuse. And so it's a good investment up front to try to keep families together and to try to achieve permanency for children as soon as possible. Funding sources are laid out on the slide, and I won't go through them. They are different for all the different players within the system, so that when you reduce the budget of one particular agency involved, it thereby has a ripple effect and makes it difficult to complete the entire process. Cost drivers. State and federal statutory and constitutional mandates, that's referring to the right to counsel that Mr. Taylor discussed. The number and complexity of cases, substance abuse and mental health, and again, it was mentioned earlier that methamphetamine is increasing. It's definitely involved in many more cases that we see in the juvenile system, as is mental health, especially with the reduction in the Oregon Health Plan. People who can't get treatment for their mental health will then get involved in the juvenile dependency system, because if they have children, they're not going to be able to care for their children, and then we will care for their children in foster care. Law enforcement staffing levels, what we mean by that is that if you put 100 extra police officers on the street, there are going to be that many more arrests, there are going to be that many more people who become involved in both the criminal justice system and the juvenile dependency and termination system. So that that drives the cost. And again, the availability of prevention, intervention, and other dispute resolution can keep these cases out of the system. And poverty was addressed earlier as well. Areas of discretion, again, there really aren't very many areas of discretion in representation and advocacy. I would title it instead areas of variability, because as attorneys we have ethical requirements to carry out our jobs, and it's not necessarily always our discretion whether we're going to settle a case. It's our client's discretion, and it's not necessarily the discretion of the district attorney whether they're going to proceed with a case. If abuse has occurred, then they're ethically required to proceed. Other areas of variability, negotiations and settlements certainly reduces the amount of cases in the system. But the need for services is a huge variable. And those services were discussed earlier. The obvious are substance abuse and mental health. There's a lot of domestic violence that is dealt with in the judicial or in the juvenile dependency system. And so that involves treatment for the batterer, treatment for the victims, parenting classes, services for children. Oftentimes children get involved in the juvenile dependency system not because they are a victim of abuse or neglect, but because they are disabled or have such high needs that their parents just simply aren't able to care for them. And those children, those treatments and those resources come out of these juvenile dependency cases, as well as housing. It's one of the most common problems for reuniting these families is trying to find affordable housing for families where poverty is an issue. The eligibility for court-appointed attorney, I would say that most of the cases in the juvenile dependency system, the parents are indigent and court-appointed attorneys are involved. Motion and trial practice is variable, but it's really not an area of discretion. And then the process for appointing a CASA. And the important thing here as well is for everyone to understand that we don't have CASAs available for every child in the system. And so the judges, along with the CASA office, have come up with a process by which they determine which cases really should have a CASA. And so they couldn't necessarily entirely replace the attorney for the child. And that said, we're open for questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Members, I'm going to ask us to keep moving. We have two additional presentations. I will ask If you have questions, write them down on tomorrow, which is our last session. We will have more time to engage with all of these presenters who've been with us. And so, again, if I can get your cooperation on that, I appreciate it. Thank you. Ms. Deborah Zay, please say hello to DA Mike Schrump.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Ray, continuing down the road.
We are now at slide 8-19 in your tabs. We're going to go into the juvenile court process. The actor, actress in the skit is in real life a juvenile court judge in Clackamas County, the Honorable Deacon Darling, and she will also be assisted today by Nancy Miller, Deputy State Court Administrator.
Thank you. Good afternoon, chairs, members of the committee.
Good afternoon.
I am happy to be here from Clackamas County. I've learned a lot about child welfare in the last few years in Clackamas County, as you might know. My name is Deanne Darling. I'm here today with Nancy Miller, who, in addition to holding the title that she was just told about, she's the director of the Citizens Review Board, known as the CRB. In child welfare, unfortunately, we frequently talk in acronyms. I'm sorry. Please interrupt me at any time. Chair Gordley, I appreciate you did that earlier, and I welcome that, because I just assume that you know what I know, and I know that's not my purpose here today. So please help me. On behalf of myself and everybody that sits as a judge, you're welcome to come to our courtrooms at any time. The old misnomer that courts are closed is over. We are open. We are open to you and to the public, to the press. I invite any one of you to contact your local judges and ask for you to spend the day with them and learn what we're really talking about, because there's no way that we can do this in a short period of time. Moving on then, who are we? We are indeed the third and co-equal branch of the government. You can see who we are made up of on the board up there. It comes as no surprise, I think, to any of you. The one that probably is a bit of a surprise are the last two, the county courts in three counties and the Citizens Review Board. I would love to have the luxury to review every case as often as I would like, which would be quite frequently, because it's amazing when court hearings are set how quickly things happen in a case. It's a phenomenon I don't understand, but it works. I don't have the time to address each case as often as I would like, and so I'm dependent upon the Citizens Review Board, as is every county, to assist us in reviewing those cases, because we do not have the frequency nor the depth of time that these cases merit. In many cases, there is a specific judge who heads the juvenile field, as in mine. That is not true in all. In some counties, you'll have multiple judges doing juvenile work every day, all day. And so you can drop in at any time. What do? We're the place where the buck stops and the decisions get made, not unlike you oftentimes. As you can see, we handle many cases. I did a little math, and if you assume that we're just a five-day-a-week court, we have 260 court days, and that doesn't count the holidays. And on those numbers up there that you see, that means we're doing 20 juvenile cases every single weekday. Those petitions often represent multiple children, because frequently sibling sets will be named in the same petition. Not always true, but in some cases they are. So while we may be talking about 20 cases every day in the state of Oregon, we may be talking about four more children. We do a minimum of 10 shelter hearings in the state every day. And that's the hearing to determine if the children have appropriately been removed from their parents or if they should be removed, the initial decision. As I told you before, I make daily decisions that affect lives of many people for a long time. Moving into the next slide, what else we are is we're the keeper of the gate for money in many ways. Much of the money that comes to the child welfare side is 4E funded, and it is the findings that we judges make that allow that money to come forward. Also, it's my job to balance the competing interests of children and families. Sometimes the competition is among sibling sets. Sometimes there's a mother that's had multiple children with multiple men. And if the fathers step forward to do their job, those siblings won't live together anymore. Those are competing interests. The competing interests, as I talked about before, are the layers of family, and Senator Bates touched upon what can often be good or dysfunctional in the layers of family. The competing rights between mothers and fathers, and the competing rights between families and the government. The primary concern that we focus on as we do our job is the health and safety concerns of children and their developmental needs for permanency. The best days in the child welfare world for me are two, when a child goes safely home forever to a safe family from which they came, or moves on to a permanent family, and that's often an adoption. I look forward to both of those days. And, in fact, they do occur in our courtrooms. Who do we affect? Well, I think we affect everybody. Not only do we affect the children and the families in our courtroom, but we affect everybody that they touch upon in their communities, their teachers, their neighbors, the other children they play with. We affect DHS. We affect CASA. We affect, obviously, lawyers. Juvenile departments often have resources dedicated to child welfare, foster parents, relatives, service providers, and on and on and on. It's one of the largest systems that I, as a judge, have ever had the privilege and the pleasure to work in. As far as our funding sources, the vast majority of our money is from the state general fund. The cost drivers, not much different than what you saw in the other slides. New laws, new timelines, new demands, staffing levels up and down, lack of training, lack of availability, services, the waiting list for services, that the needs of our families and their children are greater now than they were 10 years ago when I started this work. The rising poverty, the rising use of drugs, the rising level of unmet mental health needs, both for our children and their families, not just their parents, but their extended families that are involved. And they're ever present in my courtroom was something to say. The increased documentation that's required. 10 years ago when I started as a juvenile judge, I might have an hour of reading a day before juvenile court. I now have anywhere from 2 to 4 hours of reading. My cases would probably stack this big. On an average day, my cases would go from the floor to here. There's not necessarily more files. There's a whole lot more in them. Some of that's the product of taking longer. Some of that is the demands that we put upon the partners in this process to document everything they do. And to provide that documentation to all of us. As more and more laws, more and more lawyers, more and more interests and competing interests, grandparents' rights and step-parent rights and all those rights come to converge in the juvenile court, which is the gatekeeper of every family dispute where the government is involved or tangentially involved, more and more people are there and more is needed. In the child welfare system for juvenile judges, we do have some areas of discretion. I think that's a word sometimes that brings both good feelings and bad to you and to I. I would like to use that in a good way. I have the discretion to decide how frequently my CRB will review my cases. I have the discretion to decide how frequently I will meet with them, train them, and discuss how we can do a better job. I have the discretion to decide which families will get referred for a CASA. In my county, we're lucky to serve 1/3 of the children that need CASAs, and that's an improvement in the last 5 years by 10% at a minimum, and that's true of most CASA programs, although some are suffering. I get to decide which ones I will send out for referral for CASAs, and the CASA program decides who they will serve. I am in control of my docket, how frequently I see cases, and that assumes I have time available because there isn't something else that must be heard quickly or is knocking on the door for attention. I think my juvenile cases are the most important thing I do, and I have the luxury of letting me run those juvenile cases, and we try very hard to give them the attention that they need. And if I can't do it, and there's days when I can't do it all, I have 9 more men and women standing beside me in my county to help me. They like it when I do it, but they will help me if I need it. I decide not only what gets heard, but when it gets heard. There's strict rules that I follow regarding who gets notice. And, of course, I'm in control of what goes on in my courtroom. In the end, I have the power to follow the law and make the decisions as I see it, to decide for whom we keep hope and for whom we give up hope, who goes home and who doesn't. And I'm pleased to report that that hope is rewarded and disappointed frequently. I get the opportunity to see miracles occur in my courtroom, the miracle of a mother or a father realizing they cannot meet the needs of their child and freeing them for adoption or placement elsewhere, and the miracle of watching a family who's had the benefit of good caseworkers, good lawyers, good services, and often good foster parents bridge that gap to come back to raise their children. I have the discretion to apply the laws as you give them to me, to the information that is brought to me, so that I and every other judge sitting in a place like me, oftentimes not as controversial as my county, Clackamas, right now, but in a place often like me, to decide what we can to best do what is right in the competing interests of government and families. Questions? And I thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Chair Krieger.
Madam Chair, I sense a real dedication, Judge, that you have to your work, and it shows. I had 12 foster children over the years, and there is permanency. I got a little boy in 72, He's been coming home steady, and he spent Christmas vacation in my refrigerator. He's 40 years old or more.
Representative Chair and Representative Krieger, if I could, that's the meaning of family, is where am I going to go when I'm 40 years old and the chips are down? Where am I going to go when I'm 50 years old, 51, or 25 or 30, when the chips are down and I need help? Where am I going to go?
He also, Madam Chair, got me a Christmas present that said the dad's home bank on the front of it, you know.
Was it green?
And Madam Chair, I will be able to return tomorrow with the Chief Justice, who will be making a presentation, but Judge Darling will not be able to be here tomorrow, so if there are specific questions about what goes on in her courtroom, and you do have a few moments, we can do that now or at the end, whatever you prefer.
Members, this is one last call. Judge Darling, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your passion.
You're welcome. It's my privilege and my pleasure.
Thank you.
Chair Gordley, we actually had planned for Judge Darling's testimony to kind of light up the committee, and I didn't mean to scare folks off by urging questions not be asked until tomorrow. Our final presentation today is one of the critical pieces in this presentation. It concerns prevention and intervention. Your presenter is Mickey Lansing from the Oregon Commission on Children and Families.
As Ms. Lansing is coming forward, members, I would just note, and this is an observation on my part, in some ways perhaps a constructive criticism. It's interesting that on yesterday's agenda, we placed prevention and intervention at the end of our schedule. We're doing that again today, prevention and intervention at the end of the agenda, when perhaps that should be the beginning of our conversation. So with that said, Ms. Lansing, and I know that you have much more to say about that, please go forward.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, and I have with me today Karen Wheeler, and Karen is the manager of the alcohol and drug programs for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services through Department of Human Services. And because we work so closely together at the community level, it seemed appropriate that both of us were here today to talk about the issue of prevention. We are at the very end, I think, because for you, it is the kind of work that we do that hopefully is going to prevent all of those things, maybe not all, but many of those things that you have seen thus far. Who are we? We are 36 local commissions and a state commission on children and families whose sole responsibility is to engage citizens, mobilize communities so that they can create that web of supports 0 to 18 years of age for kids and their families, and so that they can get issues early on, either prevent them from happening in the beginning or intervene when it is most appropriate. We are also the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, who, again, work locally in community to do the same kinds of things, and we're local community addiction and mental health prevention and treatment services through contracts with local counties and with the tribes. So that's basically who we are. Together, both Karen's office and our office are very involved in what we call local comprehensive community planning. And I know planning is sort of a buzzword to some people, but if you get into the private sector, they do almost nothing without creating a strategic plan. So that's what we do together, and through that local plan for all children, all families, some specific things we pay attention to is to ensure that any services that are delivered locally are culturally competent, and that we also look at the issue of gender. for both boys and girls. So what do? We provide addiction services and mental health prevention and treatment services at the local level. We provide acute care and residential programs for pregnant women and women with dependent children, as well as adolescent treatment beds. And we make wise investments in community-based prevention and intervention programs, meaning that local citizens, local community members look at the needs in their community, they look at their strengths, they see what it is the community can do in natural touch points, and they make local decisions early on to avoid the high cost of what we call high-end services. Recently, we had a visit from Art Rolnick, who is the vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And Mr. Rolnick has made his life's work looking at services, early intervention and prevention services for children. And what he says now is that for every dollar invested early, there is a $16 return. And I'd be glad to get his information to you because he makes a very good case. We also improve the system of services to achieve both efficiency and results. So every local community has to use research, evidence-based practice, and good data in order to make decisions about what they're going to fund, whatever has the greatest impact. And they want to make sure that they maximize the use of the resource they receive.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Ms. Lansing. Going back to a previous slide, it's 828 in our notebooks, the prevention continuum.
Yes. Is it this one?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And given what you've just said about the opportunity to make those wise investments, to your knowledge, have we ever looked at each one of the components of the prevention continuum and attached dollars and cents so that we know how much we are investing currently in each one of these segments of the continuum?
Chair Gordley, what I do know is through the Partners for Children and Families, which is as a result of Senate Bill 555, so it's the coordination of several agencies, what we have done is look at how many dollars or what the resources are that go into prevention out of each one of those entities. Have we done a comprehensive sort of itemization of how much is in each of those? No, not to my knowledge. Do you know that?
Sounds like an assignment for someone. I'll pursue this with legislative counsel. I'm
good.
Just curious about what we might want. Senator Winters?
Senator Gordon, in addition to that, it may be also a good thing to add to that the amount of resource leveraging that is done that doesn't show up.
Yes.
In our state budget, this particular commission, as a part of what it does in this community planning, is also to work within its community to leverage other resources. An example in this community here in Salem, and I think it's in Portland, it's in Cottage Grove, it's in Eugene, where they have what they call relief nurseries. Some of them call resource centers here, but they actually, the community itself engages in raising the dollars. They raise the dollars because it's something that they believe that it is needed and necessary within their community. And so the percentage that we put from the state is not as great as what's coming from that community. And I think it might be well as you come back with the recommendation of the chair that you also add that dimension, because this is actually where communities have decided where they want to make some of their investments, and that's included your business communities and others in trying to get at prevention. And I want to thank the chair for raising that. We did put prevention last, which should be first.
Please continue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Gordley and members of the committee. Another thing, and it speaks to what Senator Winters just said, is that we act as a stimulus for public and private partners to invest additional programs or additional resources in programs and services. And as part of that, right now we are working with the Oregon Community Foundation around parenting classes for a variety of ages. We are working with the Ford Family Foundation on linking communities with schools, especially in rural areas, because what we know about human services wrapping around schools is that you get much better outcomes for kids, especially who live in poverty and youth of color, if in fact they can access services in that particular setting. We're working with a private group in Portland called Innovation Partners, who is looking at the early childhood system and, again, a return on the investment. And what they say is we as business people have got to stand together and really talk about the return on our investment. It's not only a moral responsibility, but it's an economic necessity, and you're going to be hearing more from those folks later on. And we also work with Oregon Partnership, which is a community-based nonprofit organization who specifically targets the reduction of alcohol and drug abuse. Who do we affect? We affect pregnant women and families. We have home visitation for women prenatally who are going to have their firstborn children. We affect children 0 to 18 years of age in school and community-based prevention schools, again, linking communities with schools, where you have parenting classes, before and after school care, tutoring, mentoring programs. Again, juvenile crime, most juvenile crime is committed between 3 and 6 p.m. in the evening. We have child care settings where we affect especially the quality and the quantity of child care in this state. And it includes children who are in treatment with their parents. We affect children at risk of abuse and neglect. The Healthy Start program is, again, a program in 36 counties for firstborn children and their families. And most of those clients in those programs are people who are really at risk of abusing or neglecting their children. We work with Babies First and Cocoon. Babies First and Cocoon are both programs, one through the Health Division and one through Oregon Health Sciences University, all working together, not duplicating our efforts, but ensuring that those high-risk families get the kind of support they need early on.
Ms. Lansing?
Yes.
May I stop you there?
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded that a couple of sessions ago, maybe it was three sessions ago, we passed a bill with no funding that encouraged the training of child care workers and parents.
Yes.
So that they would better understand how the brain. This was an effort to really wrap our arms around what's needed by that population 0 to 3 in. Again, understanding how much youngsters can learn that early. I'm not saying this very elegantly, but you're picking up on what I'm trying to communicate. Where are we with that initiative?
I am. Yes, Chair Gordley, one of the things that we haven't been able to do as much of, we did have an initiative called Oregon's Child, Everyone's Business that was through the Child Care Division, through the Commission, through the Department of Education, through Department of Human Services. We all work together training community people around the importance of brain development and have some excellent results. Portland State University now is in charge of that community training.
I know the Oregon Department of Education, in fact, we just worked with them. They are doing training starting next month in approximately 8 communities, again, to train caregivers, teachers, other people who work with children on a daily basis. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And we'll do some follow-up in the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. We work with children who are referred by the court to CASAS, court-appointed special advocates. You heard that early on. Again, only 30% of the eligible children are able to have a CASA at this point in time. We work with children and families needing intensive intervention services. This is where relief nurseries, Senator Winters talked about them, but these are people who provide therapeutic classrooms, parenting education, do referrals to affordable housing, do all kinds of things, but again, wrap around that child and that family to see they get what they need. And their rates of keeping kids out of the foster care system are about 98.2% of their kids and families are free from abuse. They do a wonderful job. We work with residential programs for pregnant women and women with children. So, in fact, they no longer have that addiction. We work with children who have antisocial behavior. One of the programs that is a promising practice program out of the University of Oregon is called First Steps, where you identify children at 5 years of age or six, kindergarten preferably, and those teachers are trained. They work with the children and with the family to ensure that those kids do not go further in terms of their out-of-control behavior. Excellent program with great results. And then we work with youth who have chronic acting out behaviors, teen parents, homeless youth, youth with alcohol and mental health issues, and we do family counseling. Our funding sources are state general fund, lottery funds, local general fund from counties, federal funds, nonprofit and foundation grants, and beer and wine tax. And again, one of the things communities are trying to do is diversify their funding base, not just individual programs, but other public entities, saying that we know we need other kinds of funding, not just to rely on government funds. The cost drivers are family demographics that include the birth rate, decreases in family income, and this is a huge issue for many communities, unemployment, lack of a family wage job, poverty. All these things potentially increase alcohol and drug use, contribute to mental health problems, and also can cause domestic violence and child abuse and neglect. We work with adult and youth substance abuse. We know that trends in different things, such as the issue with meth, can be a huge issue. Changes in federal and state investments in prevention and treatment, and federal and state mandates. Our areas of discretion. We need to make decisions regarding where to invest the finite resources we have, where they can have the greatest impact. We have to make decisions regarding what policies are pivotal to the success of children and youth.
Ms. Lansing?
Yes.
May I stop you there just for a moment for Representative Richardson's question?
Madam Chair, members of this committee, and I would like to just focus on what you've been saying, mm-hmm. because your focus on all of the things that you're doing is about lifting people out of difficult circumstances, solving the problem of poverty, not by politicizing it, by saying, do you qualify because you're beneath 100% of federal poverty level, and sorry, you make a buck more, and so you don't get any benefits. But what you're focusing on is helping people, whatever their need is, at the local level, a community-based solution to help lift people out of those problems so that they can become self-reliant. And Senator Winters, a few moments ago, mentioned about the large amount of contributions that take place from the community. And just since the tsunami, I heard that the report, it was hard to believe that one out of three members of in America have contributed to the relief of tsunami victims across the country, I mean across the world. And why? Because there's a need and because it's charity. But we try and pass a tax increase and the people say, I understand there's plenty of needs, but you're not going to raise our taxes. And so my comment is that while people in Oregon resist tax increases, they're more than generous. They're amazingly generous when it comes to neighbors helping neighbors in need. And the work that you're doing and the focus that your group has on community-based solutions is the future for delivery of welfare services. Because if you do the math on the cost of just merely increasing funding for organizations, it's unsustainable over time. But if we can further the model of having communities organized to utilize local community resources first and government community resources to fill the difference, then we have a chance of actually lifting people out of poverty, whatever that is defined in their unique circumstance, rather than merely determining whether they qualify for benefits because of some standard that was set years ago. So anyway, I just commend you in what you're doing, and I hope that we watch for opportunities to develop the community-based model.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Did you wish to respond, or would you like to continue?
I just would like to finish, and then I'll let Karen say whatever she would like to say. For one thing, I do have something that does say why we must make wise investments in children and their families. And I think it has some really good statistics for you to look at in terms of cost savings. And just one, at least 79% of the Oregon adult prison population were dropouts at time of incarceration. School dropouts are four times more likely to be covered by the Oregon Health Plan, more than twice as likely to be unemployed, and if employed, earn an average of 30% less in wages. There are about five or six things here. We have all the sightings so that you can see where we got the information, and then we have a little thing that talks about too little, too late in terms of cost and intensity of service. I also want to leave you with a wonderful quote by Albert Einstein, and that is, he says, brilliant people solve problems, but geniuses prevent them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lansing. Turning now to Karen Wheeler. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gordley, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Alcohol and Drug Policy Manager with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services at the Department of Human Services. And I didn't want to say very much or take very much time. I just wanted to really state the need for prevention. And I'll start just by making the link between substance abuse, and I know that methamphetamine has been brought up several times today and yesterday. We do fund residential treatment programs for women, pregnant women, and women with children. And I just want to say that some of the increased needs of these programs, or these people entering these programs, have to do with their medical conditions, dental, and mental health needs. Earlier on in the lifespan, we also have services for adolescents, residential treatment for adolescents, as well as outpatient treatment. And we have seen a growth in the number of especially young girls under the age of 17 who are entering our treatment programs because of methamphetamine. And I will also just connect one more dot. We've seen an increase in the number of girls drinking at eighth grade. Our latest youth risk behavior survey indicates that the number of girls surpasses boys in terms of drinking at eighth grade. And we know that the first drug kids try is alcohol. Usually the next drug they try is marijuana. And in Oregon, it seems to be that methamphetamine follows that. So that is the connection that I would like to make today. And if you have any questions, I'd entertain those questions about treatment.
We will have an opportunity tomorrow to further explore what is happening with the population of girls in Oregon, and we appreciate you opening that door, that conversational door for us this afternoon. Any questions or comments for the presenters?
Madam Chair, didn't you say you'd like us to wait until tomorrow to ask questions?
we've kind of shifted in our presentations while you've been out of the room, Senator Carter. So we're in a good place right now.
My question would be, what strategies are you using to get to the girls in terms of helping to, you know, to them to hopefully defer their decision-making processes toward the use of alcohol and drugs at this particular point? Because I don't think just saying no is reason enough for kids at that age group to decide, I don't want it because I should say no. And so I'd like to know, what kind of strategies are you using to get to that population?
Chair Gordley, Senator Carter, and members of the committee, we do have a number of different prevention strategies that are in place at the local level, both at the county level, community level, at the tribal level. We have some gender-specific prevention strategies that are in place. There's not enough. We also have gender-specific treatment strategies, especially with adolescents. The groups are separate. The boys and girls are not mixed in groups.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your presentation. And Chair Krieger, I'd like to go back to you, because I cut you off earlier when you had a question or a comment for one of the earlier panels.
And I'm sure it pretty well got covered.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Ms. Ray, would you like to summarize and give us a preview of tomorrow's work?
Did you get the impression Mickey has some energy on prevention and intervention? It's always a delight to listen to that. Hopefully we have continued with our goal of showing you how things in the public safety system continue to be so interrelated. Tomorrow we will have a budget presentation for you, a brief overview by the legislative fiscal staff on those various budgets that the Ways and Means Public Safety and Human Services subcommittees will see, that will give folks in the judiciary committees an opportunity to know the policy issues that you'll be deciding have a direct dollar impact, and see how everything just kind of all fits together. We'll also, after that, we'll have a panel presentation where we'll engage in an if you do this, then this is the consequence, because Ms. Ray loves company. Come on, that was to kind of lighten it up just a little bit.
It's okay about being corny.
Thank you very much, Senator Carter. Chief Justice Wallace P. Carson will be here tomorrow, as will Craig Campbell, the governor's senior policy advisor for public safety. So, and we'll be prepared to answer your questions from yesterday, and if there are others, we're more than happy to take those now and start preparing our cast for tomorrow.
Other questions or comments?
Ms. Ray loves
coffee. Or anything for the good of the order? We thank everyone for being here, and we'll see you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock sharp. Have a great afternoon.
If you love company that much, how come you weren't?